So as I mentioned at the beginning, this is a form of a contemplative inquiry. Contemplative means that ideally we begin to investigate these particular topics or things you hear from the point of view of a little bit more calmness of mind, or you say that would be a less judgmental mind. Also, I hope, less critical. No. A certain degree of critical faculty is helpful, too, in Buddhist teachings, because it's not a matter of just accepting it, believing it, but investigating. Yeah, it sounds okay. Let's try it out. Let's look closer at it. And I mentioned also earlier that spirituality to me needs to be the whole picture, including the body, which is sensation, and what we might call emotion. There's sometimes a little bit of complications with translations, because the Buddha gave these teachings 2,500 years ago, and maybe some of the ways of understanding things are a bit different than today. And he used different words to explain certain areas of our experience, and sometimes a bit of difficulty with translating them into the present time, into English in the present time. So one of them is a particular, I mention emotion, but in the Buddha's time, emotion was actually a mental activity, a state of mind. But the Buddha referred to, rather than emotion, he referred to what's in Pali, the Pali language is called Vedana, which I translate as feeling tone. And I mentioned this, the sensation, the body, this emotion, feeling tone, and the mind, mental activity or mentality. And this is basically, some of you probably recognize, this is the themes for developing mindfulness. The four areas to develop mindfulness: body, feeling tone, states of mind, and then there's a fourth one called the Dhammas, which includes, you can say simply, specific or particular states of mind or ways of looking at some of our experience. So it's kind of a refinement, too. I realize that my experience has been actually that, in the many Western countries, now in Thailand too, the culture has emphasized conceptualizing a lot. When I first went to Thailand, our monastery in northeast Thailand was up in the countryside, a small village, rice farmers, and the people there didn't need to think a lot. But of course, if you're a rice farmer, anybody a rice farmer here? Need to use your body a lot. So they were so in tune with their bodies, it was amazing. They just kind of flow into the room and sit down, and it was like it's almost, to be a bit romantic, sort of like a waltz. They'd waltz into the room and sit down, and they had such an amazing awareness of their physical presence. And in Thai society, they have a very refined etiquette about where you sit and how you sit and all these kind of things. In the monastery, anyway, the monastery etiquette is that, the monks are kind of the top of the social scale. We're the most respected part of the Thai society. Monks first, then the king. Of course, the practicality, the king never bows to a monk, but but he should. But we'll forgive him because. So for example, when people come into the monastery, they have this. They know where they're going to sit in proximity to the Buddha image and to the monks, and according to their kind of social position. So once I was the senior monk at Wat Nanachat, by default, because the abbot was away. And I think it was the Minister of Agriculture was coming to visit. And I don't know all this Thai etiquette stuff, you know. So I thought, how am I going to tell who's the minister? So anyway, this group of Thais came in, and they approached where I was sitting, and the other few other monks were there, and they all just sat down in a certain way, and I knew he's the minister, that's his wife, that's the second, third person in importance, that's the fourth, fifth, sixth. And the guard stood at the door, and you know, the kind of servant stood at the door, and I knew exactly who was the most important person without a word being said. Nobody said anything. They all came in and just sat down in the right place. And then when I saw some Western people coming, oh my goodness, I couldn't watch. Come bumbling into the room. Said, that was me too. You know? I was like that, no body awareness, totally disembodied, basically. But generally speaking, I think Buddha recognized that being aware of the sensations in the body was reasonably obvious, more subtle, I mean, more coarse, as it were, than feeling tones, than states of mind, you see. So it's like a progression, I would say. First being aware of physicality, then feeling tones, and then states of mind, and then particular states of mind. So this requires a development of mindfulness or awareness, generally speaking. You know, but unfortunately, many of us, maybe we start off with we're more, I don't know if we're aware of our states of mind, but we're more up in our heads anyway. So maybe if I mention this, beware of your sensations of the body. What's that? What body? Yeah. But it is very helpful, at least I would say it's very helpful, because to be aware of sensation, which is non-conceptual, you have to step away from the conceptualizing. You're over-conceptualizing. So it is very helpful then for developing concentration, and you know, we won't, maybe it's hard, we have to struggle with it in the beginning perhaps a little bit, but it's a very helpful, skillful means to use to step away from our, rather than fight with our thinking, fight with our thoughts. Otherwise, most people are just, they're either thinking or they're not, or they're fighting with their thinking. Stop, shut up, don't think. You know? But it's not, it's a very aggressive way, and it'll create more tension in your body and your mind. Whereas you just move your attention from your thoughts to your body, the thoughts fade away because you aren't paying attention to them. But you pay attention to your thoughts, and then you think about the thought, think about the thought, about the thought, about the thought, and, oh, my headache. But turn your attention to the body, and what thought? Not attending to it. And then it doesn't trigger off all the other train of thought. Ideally. Probably you look at the body, and then you start thinking about the body then, right? Because you're so used to thinking. Instead of thinking about your thoughts, you think about the body. But then at least you know you're thinking about your body and not just being aware of the sensations of the body. So, okay, no, I recognize that. Oh, now, what does it mean to just be aware of sensation? Like I must admit myself, when I took up this meditation on the breathing, I realized for months, maybe even years, I was just being aware of the concept of breathing. What am I doing? I'm sitting here in Thailand. I'm watching my breathing. Watching my breathing. And then one day, oh, breathing. That's what it feels like without the conceptualizing. And it was very peaceful, just watching breathing, experience of breathing and not having to think about it. And then you realize how heavy thinking is, how exhausting thinking is. You know, it's just like when you notice that, then, oh, my head is, oh, so heavy from thinking. And one of Ajahn Chah's teachings was, you know, when you're listening to a talk, he said, listen from the heart. You know what that means? Don't listen with your brain, with your head. Listen with your heart. You know what that means? Huh? He said, have your attention here and you experience it then. It's, you know, maybe we could, maybe simplistically I can say that this up here is the center of conceptualizing, and here is more experiential. And in the Thai culture, you know, literally the word to understand means enter the heart. If we say, oh, I understand, he said, no, 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 no. The brain just picks up information, and then it's processed in the heart. It's the heart that understands here. I don't think it's physically the heart. You know, the heart represents, it's symbolic of a more full experience, which I would say, you know, in our English language, this then puts together this sensation there, this feeling tone, and there's states of mind manifest here. Here there's no sensation. It's only concepts. And mostly there's no feeling either. There's no feeling tone up here. It's just brain, just concepts, just thinking. Here there is sensation. I mentioned that exercise that we moved our attention through the body. Remember, there's these phrases in English, you know, heavy-hearted, light-hearted. Huh? So there's part of that light-hearted or heavy-hearted is a physical sensation. It was the feel, the heaviness. Huh? But what's the heartedness, heavy-hearted? The hearted isn't, you aren't listening to your heartbeat. Huh? The heavy is the physical and the heart is the emotional. And, you know, in Buddhism, emotional, mental. Because many of these so-called mental states, you know, like the first three states to be aware of in the development of mindfulness is to be aware of greed, aversion, delusion. Are they emotions or are they concepts? Greed. Are you emotionally greedy or intellectually greedy? Are you emotionally angry or intellectually angry? Eh? Well, the feeling is anger, right? But then what are you angry about? Then this intellectual comes in, you see? But that manifests here. But if you try and find anger in your brain, it's just thoughts, isn't it? Oh, that person did that, and I think it's like this, and I think they said that, and I think I feel. Well, what do you feel, actually? You have to go here, right? Or at least to the body anyway, because if you develop the exercise more, you'll notice that the body is also, the emotions are also expressed through the body. When I gave that mention about, can you notice the sensation or where you sense holding in the body? Then if you're angry, notice what the body is doing, huh? What you're holding in the body. And it's anger. Well, it's maybe not, of course, not in a Buddhist context, right? Who's angry, right? We're being Buddhist. We're not angry or greedy or... At least for the day, anyway. But as just in the very exercise of being aware, of these areas of our experience, you know, initially the Buddha points them out, you know, as a conscious exercise, bring attention to the body. Bring attention to feeling. I mean, I was started off with this translation difficulty here, because generally the word Vedana is translated as feeling in translation, but it gets confusing, doesn't it? If I ask you how you're feeling, you don't say pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. You say I'm feeling good or bad or whatever. You give an emotional response. Whereas the Buddha defines Vedana, this so-called feeling, I say feeling tone, because it is very, very, it's the general emotional tone of your experience. And very simple, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. Simple. Yeah. That's kind of simplifying your emotions. Yeah. I also, a little bit facetiously, say, well, there's one body, three feelings and lots of states, and 16 states of mind the Buddha specifically mentions to be aware of, but there's a lot more than that. And then there's the dhammas are much more. I mean, I should count them, actually. But, I mean, there's 30 or so of these but specific states of mind to be aware of. But so it gets a little bit more, you know, complex. Maybe not quite so simple, one body, but lots of sensations. Huh? But the feeling... In a Buddhist frame of reference, is just the feeling tone, generally pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. But you notice also it's on a continuum. You know, one side is pleasant and the other side is unpleasant. Who's looking at this side? I only see the pleasant side. And the middle is neutral. Because neutral literally means neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So when you look at your feeling tone, it's somewhere on this continuum of this kind of experience, feeling tone, you see. And go all the way from pleasant feeling tone, you know, there's a great variety there. It can be ecstasy, it can be just, I like it, or it's pleasant. It can be absolute misery and totally unbearable to just a little bit uncomfortable. But just, I find the benefit of that is, you know, the emotions can be quite complicated, but if you just have this reference, is it pleasant or unpleasant or neutral? This can kind of gives you a different perspective on it, different outlook, you know, a simplified outlook on our emotions. And then if you become more familiar with that, then maybe you can apply the same sort of template or level of observation to your states of mind, where many of us have a lot of investment in our states of mind, right? And emotions too. You know, if anger arises, well, you know, you quickly start to engage with it personally, my kind of anger, and I have a right to be angry, and that person, you know, a lot of personal history in that with emotions. Where pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, well, I got some emotion, I got some history there too, but not so complicated. And in the body, what's the body response of that particular state of mind, for example, and a little bit, maybe it's a whole new experience. Oh, I have no history there because I never noticed that emotion as a physical expression. No, I got it's a new experience of feeling an angry body, you know, feeling myself feeling angry. Boy, goodness, 67 years of history. But observing the angry body, oh, that's totally new. I never noticed the angry body before. So you get, you know, it helps you to get a different perspective. And if we can develop awareness in these various areas of our experience, we can be very flexible in how to relate to them in a more skillful way than be spun off into our usual self-centered and self-reinforcing habits again. So, whoops, a little bit, only a few minutes for some questions before we break for lunch, before we break for eating meditation. This is experience group, or is everybody so peacefully, their mind isn't working. Okay, yeah. I would say it depends upon your level of experience. I mean, practically, I would say just start off with watching the breath. You know. So you build a foundation of calm and a bit more clarity, and then you can then expand that. You can use that calm and that clarity now to expand your repertoire of areas of investigation, of clarity, be more clear about more areas of our experience, and be able to, you can say, maintain or preserve a certain degree of calm, you know. Ideally, we learn meditation in a comfortable, conducive, supportive environment. And then, not just to leave it there on your cushion, but to take this into your everyday life. And for many people, that's everyday life is more complicated than sitting in this nice, peaceful environment and with your mobile phone turned off. Yeah. Right? It's probably more peaceful here than at home, I guess, huh? I don't know. But if you learn some lessons here in this kind of classroom situation, ideally you'd be better prepared to apply that in ordinary life situation. Which, you know, I mean, my life anyway is not that organized as this, you see. Even my life. we don't always have a retreat either. You know, our monastery isn't one complete retreat, you know. And we have to deal with difficulties too sometimes. So, but it's like, you know, we have times for retreat to kind of give us the favorable environment to develop some skillful tools, how to work with my mind and the stuff that can come up in it. And then when I do engage with difficult situations, if I have to, then I'm more prepared for it, better prepared for it. So there's a danger, you know, from hearing all these things, you have to apply all of them. I have to kind of give a range of information or suggestions, etc., because there's a variety of people here, and whatever you find useful and helpful for you at this time, well, just use that. Forget the rest. Okay? Does that make that was your sort of answered your question?
Not really, but
I would say, you know, eventually if you want to pursue this particular Buddhist meditation path, it's helpful to learn about all the different possibilities. And especially when we need to engage with a wider range of experiences. Now, if you just continue with watching your breath, you'll find that things will come up. And if you haven't got the tools there, it can be sometimes too much, can't handle it. So if you have the opportunity to at least hear about and ideally put into practice some of the various techniques or teachings the Buddha gave. You know, he was teaching a huge range of people for 45 years. So he gave a lot of different advice to different people, and maybe sometime we can benefit from that advice. Other stuff we don't need. Yeah, other things we don't need because it's not suitable to our temperament or us at this time in our particular stage in the practice or something. So yeah, is it clear yet? No?
It's good.
Okay.
Do you think it's vital to have a teacher as you progress?
I wouldn't say necessary, but sometimes it can be helpful. I mean, I would say that the Buddha's approach, and Ajahn Chah emphasized this too, that, you know, first of all, you ask yourself, you try and work with this yourself, because only you can be your own teacher. I mean, the teacher, unless he's got psychic powers and read your mind, it's very hard for him to know where you're really at. Yeah, but there is, at the same time, there is sort of patterns that people, as people go through spiritual practice, there is common patterns. You know, we're all human beings, and so we progress in certain ways, and so we manifest kind of particular common patterns, but then we're also individuals too. Yeah. So, you know, even in these techniques or these particular teachings the Buddha gave, I would say they only provide a general pattern that we can follow. But we have to improvise ourselves. We've got to improvise them to suit our own particular temperament at this time and this place. And then maybe in 2 weeks, we got to try something else because we've already passed through that stage, you see. Like we have different ways to relate to our coarse level of aversion or something. But then there's a more subtler level, exposes another more subtler level of aversion. It's not that I kind of blow up with anger, but there's some simmering resentment there, you know, which maybe is worth attending to and working with for a while. And then below that, there is just some resistance or something, more subtler level of this common human tendency for pushing things away, aversion complex, you see. So as mindfulness gets more and more subtle, you begin to notice subtler levels of this stuff, you know, down to the energetic level, maybe. So, I mean, there's a saying that, I don't think it comes from Buddhism, but when the student is ready, the teacher appears. Rather than go out and look for a teacher, if you're kind of working on a certain issue and you have trouble with it, you know, certain things manifest that, or are you able to relate to them as a teaching experience? Like Ajahn Chah said, everything's teaching us. And I would paraphrase it, when you're ready for it. There's some lessons I'm not ready for yet. I think there was one over here too somewhere. Is there a hand still up?
Okay.
Okay.
Can you provide more instruction on observing mind states without getting into the self mind?
Well, basically, you can say at one level, having more concentration or calmness of mind. Calmness of mind is facilitated by focused attention. So you focus attention and your mind calms down a bit more. It calms down the reactive, my self-reactiveness. However, there's a few dangers with that too, that sometimes your mind gets so calm, nothing to see but calm. No problems. It can also put to sleep your problems too. Not necessarily make them more clear. So you have to bring in mindfulness as well as concentration, you see. But so you kind of balance out concentration and mindfulness, awareness and concentration, you know, and you have to find out for yourself what's suitable for you. Like some people, they may be temperamentally very reactive emotionally. They might need quite a bit of calming down. And the more calmness you have, my experience of it is you find you get more space between what you're aware of and how you react to it. There's more space there. So it's a possibility then to somehow interfere with, even suspend the reaction, the automatic self-reaction to these particular experiences. But the Buddha's pointing out really to use that to notice how the self does that reaction. Why is it reacting? What's your trigger? What's the basic trigger for all this reactiveness? Things are there, and you know, life is the way it is, and it's your ego that says, "I like this, I don't like that. I want to be this way, I don't want to be that way." You know, but it's really a hard job to keep up with, you know. Because life doesn't always just give you the things you like and take away the things you don't like. In fact, rarely it does that, you know. So when you can be able to just receive whatever comes along, no reaction to it, but you know, it's a matter of seeing what's the trigger, the reactive trigger for all this stuff. And that's your kind of core self, if you like. Your core defensive self, and basically your persona doesn't want you to see that, because that's a hidden secret, that's the self secret, why you do things. You know, you've asked yourself, why did I do that? So, well, never mind. Just keep doing it, because it supports my self image. So just keep doing it. Don't look any closer. But if you find out some of these underlying compulsions, wow, interesting. And maybe there's a possibility to undo them, unplug them, unravel them, whatever.
Specifically.
Could I put it off to the afternoon?
Of course.
Yeah. Yeah. Not that I'm getting hungry, it's just that it's a little bit more specific to certain aspects of experience. So if I forget, remind me. I mean, whatever really supports, you know, more calmness of mind, whatever supports it. You know, sometimes by going to other parts of the body, maybe they're a bit more energized or something, and then you might trigger off more thinking about it rather than just watching it. You see? But if you can observe, especially as I mentioned in the last sitting, I think about if there's any other sensation which is more obvious, you know, pressure or something or other, more obvious, and you can just settle your awareness on that without getting spun off into thinking, then fine. And whatever is more obvious is easier. And generally speaking, the longer you sit, the more subtle the breath gets. So, you know, if you have other tools, other objects of awareness, then you have a bit more wider repertoire how to support concentration or calm or focused attention then. So maybe try it out and see if it works or not, basically. There's something to be said for the continuity of keep having the same thing over and over again, because anything new, you know, your mind is kind of oh, what's that? Then maybe certain new things, it also has, you have a history with it or an association, and that triggers off a whole train of thought. And I know some people have a history with breathing, too. They can't use breathing because they've got asthma or something, and looking at the breath reminds them of all that history and stuff, and they need to find another meditation object which will support focused attention and calm. And so. But for most people, generally breathing is the most common and useful and general one. So, so maybe it's time for a pause. And as I mentioned, I referred to eating meditation. So if you're aware, if you're developing this awareness of sensation, eating is a very interesting sensation. And there's a lot of kind of very basic emotions around it, huh? We're trying to maintain what we call the noble silence. You know, when we start talking, it stirs up thoughts, and then thinking stirs up the mind again. And so, to support the group, we can maintain some degree of calmness of speaking, against speaking, and if you can be a bit more aware of the act of eating your food, mindful eating, you may find it very interesting.